I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The U.S. healthcare system costs $2.6 trillion a year, and every year that number increases by billions and billions of dollars. There are many explanations: an aging population, expensive high-tech procedures, excessive paperwork and administrative costs, the fee structure, the chronic diseases associated with obesity. It's a long list. Our guest is oncologist Ezekiel Emanuel. He wrote a series in the New York Times about the high cost of medical care in this country and what to do about it. He's currently the vice provost of global initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania, where he chairs the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy. He was a healthcare advisor to the Obama administration when the country was in the throes of a heated debate about healthcare reform. We asked him to talk with us about the cost and quality of our healthcare system and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Ezekiel Emanuel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And preparing for the interview with you, I'm thrown back to the year 2009, 2010. Do you think we have settled some of those hot debates about healthcare system?
Well, we obviously haven't settled them. We have a Supreme Court case which will have to be ruled on before June 2012. But I think we have a world historical event in the passage of the Affordable Care Act. And I've on record as saying that I think it's a major catalyst to reform in the system. And I think by the end of the decade, 2020, we will have a much better healthcare system because of it.
It's an expensive healthcare system, and it's a complicated healthcare system. Are those two connected?
They are connected, but healthcare, even if it were cheaper than what we spend, is still a very complicated system. You're dealing with lots of different patients. That's one thing. You're dealing with lots of different diseases. You're dealing with care in many, many places, in the hospital, in the clinics, rehabilitation services, pharmacy services, nursing homes. So there's just an enormous amount of complexity. And we, of course, in America make things even more complex because we have many, many different payers. And that, what's called the fragmentation of the payment system, also makes it hard to give one single incentive to doctors and one single incentive to hospitals with a clear voice.
You wrote about having a minor biopsy, I guess, and all the paperwork that you had to fill out, and I think we can all identify with what you did.
Right, and it's that's a phenomenal added complexity to it, which is even in the same system, and all these doctors were affiliated with the same hospital system. You didn't have this piece of paper in an electronic format that could be called up in every office that I went to. So everyone had me fill it out differently. It's infuriating to patients, especially when you're doing a sort of surgical procedure. You see a doctor, you go to the operating room, and then on top of that is the bills. All of that is a problem. And I do think because of the Affordable Care Act, it's going to get better. There are things we could do to push the reforms even further and faster, but the Affordable Care Act does guarantee that we'll have electronic health records. All Americans by the end of the decade will have interoperable electronic health records. That's going to be a big plus. Hopefully that'll get rid of filling out those forms with allergies and medications and your past medical history. And I think the billing's slated to get better. And that's the major place where I think the government could actually do more.
And obviously those two are connected. If you have e-records, then it's easier to do billing.
Correct.
And even to root out abuse, fraud?
Yes. Right? Well, MasterCard and Visa have done a remarkable job of having electronic screens to look for patterns that are suggestive of fraud, to look for billing sequences electronically. Now, sometimes they get it wrong. Recently, I was in Paris, and they stopped my credit card because, you know, suddenly something unusual from Paris in a place that they didn't think I might be. So they might overreact. On the other hand, it does prevent a lot of fraud, and, you know, getting that balance right is very important. But the electronic assessments of patterns and looking for screens is going to, once we get the electronic billing, help enormously. Now, many insurance companies have it now. The government is less vigorous about it, although, again, as part of the Affordable Care Act, there is a provision for doing more of that. It does save billions of dollars.
We've had physicians call into the show. You know, these are physicians with an office and a gigantic staff trying to keep up with providing services to their patients. And they say, we don't have time. We don't have the technology. We cannot take all these paper records and turn them into e-records.
Right.
Are you sympathetic to that? How hard it is to do that?
I was trained as a chemist, so my undergraduate degree is in chemistry, and I have a master's in biochemistry. And one of the things I like to say is, in chemical reactions, you can start out with some chemical constituents, and at the end, you get a nice product. That could be a very efficient process, but there's a what we call a potential energy barrier have to go through, which costs a lot of energy. It's a lot. It's complex. Things are distorted. That's what we're going through. There is going to be, it is inevitable when you have change of a big system, 5-10 years of pain and false starts and problems. At the end, the system's going to be a lot better. There is no way to get from here to there without some pain and without some changing of standard operating procedure, business as usual. But we want business as usual to change. We want a modernized system. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we can get there without some pain. So I sympathize with everyone that says, this is hard.
Yes.
This is really taking a lot of effort. Absolutely. But is there any way to get from where we are at, which is not pleasant, to a better system without that? I don't know. I mean, I'll use a different metaphor.
Go ahead.
All of us who've been parents to adolescents.
Been there, done that.
Right,
yes.
Exactly. No, you know, adolescence is a really trying time, really stressful, causes baldness and gray hair. On the other hand, you get to the other end, and they're really wonderful people who you actually really love.
You're promising us in 10 years.
And I don't know how to go through without the adolescence. That's part of getting to the other side. And I think the analogy is the same here. We've got to get to a modernized system, that it's electronic, that allows us to actually get records wherever we are, that allows us to have decision supports to doctors as healthcare is getting ever more complicated. And getting from here to there is going to be hard. I agree. But we have to do it.
You think it's going to be worth it?
It's inevitable, and we have to do it.
What about the role and responsibility of patients? And I ask that, of course, knowing that we have an obesity epidemic. I don't think I'm overstating that by using the word epidemic and
right.
Then all the problems that come with that. These are chronic and expensive conditions to care for. Now, some are, you know, the result of someone's biochemistry, and some are because of lifestyle. What responsibility do you put on patients, the American public themselves, to take better care of themselves?
That is a very complicated question, in part because our habits and our proclivities, like what do we eat, are not simply our free choice. We do live, as we well know, in a social system that encourages us to do these things. I did have
eat fatty food.
Yeah, eat fatty food, eat fast food, which have a certain profile. It's not so much fatty food, it's carbohydrates. Not to have a lot of fruits and vegetables readily available, especially in inner cities and rural areas. When I was in the White House, I worked on the First Lady's Obesity Initiative, and I was privileged enough to really get into the obesity issue. But one of the things we have to be clear is there is some element of responsibility, but there's a huge element of social incentive and disincentive. And I think the right analogy for people to think about is smoking. We didn't get to, you know, 50% of the population smoking in the early 1960s because people voluntarily decided they'd like to smoke. There were lots of incentives there. There were advertisements. They were cheap. The government provided them to World War II soldiers, etc. So, and we provided tobacco price supports to make sure that tobacco could be cheap. But when we decided to change, a whole series of things went in, not like flipping a switch, but over time. We increased the taxes on cigarettes. We made it socially unacceptable. We took advertising off the TV. We have completely changed how we view it. It's no longer a positive with doctors endorsing smoking. It's a complete negative. The same thing is, I think, we're in this transition around food. We are solving the food desert problem. You know, now Walgreens announced that it's going to have food in lots of its stores that are in inner cities.
Actual food, right?
Yeah, well, fruits and vegetables. Right. We recognize that this is a problem. We've got lots of encouragement. We haven't completely shifted, but we're at the start of a change. You know, all the big food companies are trying to think, how can they do things differently, better? They're looking at reducing the calories and changing the composition. We're not at nirvana. It's going to take time to make that switch. But again, I think we have in the developed world the lowest smoking rate, much lower than most of Europe, than all of Europe as far as I know. I think over time we're going to solve this obesity thing. Making fun of people, I think, doesn't recognize the social milieu in which they're in and the biological phenomena.
Let me ask you about something else, and this I saw in the paper recently. I'm quoting from the Associated Press. Give people free prescription drugs, and many of them still won't bother to take their medicine. Doctors were stunned to see that happen in a major study involving heart attack survivors, and they go on from there. The idea that you can give people free drugs to help them, and they're ill, and you don't get the kind of compliance that you need.
So if you look at the wellness literature, so where companies provide people an ability to be screened, to fill out a form and find out about their lifestyle, and then to get screened for blood pressure and cholesterol and diabetes and smoking. And one of the things that the sort of motto in that area is, free is not cheap enough. And there are many things in American society where free is not cheap enough. So to get people to participate in wellness, you can get 20 to 40% of people at a company to participate for nothing. But to go from 40 to 80, which is where the best companies are, you have to provide them incentives, whether it's money, charitable donations, other time off. You have to provide some incentive. So even when it's free and for their benefit. So I'm not surprised by that. The question is, why are people, first of all, that unconcerned about their health? Mm-hmm. No, they're very busy people. This is a big imposition on them. Most of us know that the hardest thing for us to do, change our lifestyle, whether it's to get regular exercise, change what we eat, et cetera. So we're asking people to do one of the hardest things in their life, and we do have to help them. Taking a medication every day is not trivial.
So you're saying, that's fascinating. You're saying that free isn't cheap enough, but the idea of actually paying someone to take their medicine would be a good incentive? And we're almost up in a break, but go ahead.
Look, I think that's the kind of thing that we have to study. I don't want to recommend, and I'm not an expert on the literature, as to whether if you actually pay people to adhere to their medicines, they do it better, and whether that's cost effective. You'd have to ask the question, well, is that adherence actually result in reductions? I do know there are many other things we can do with people to actually get the compliance up to 99%. Instead of having them leave the doctor's office with a prescription, we can actually give them the medicine or have it delivered at home, especially for people with chronic illness where getting to the pharmacy could be hard. So we can talk about some of the other ways we can incentivize adherence after the break.
And that's Ezekiel Emanuel taking over Radio Times here on the air, Vice Provost of Global Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania. And he's been writing in the New York Times about our healthcare system. In fact, was a healthcare advisor for the Obama administration. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Hands from the Heart Home Healthcare Services, providing non-medical in-home assistance to seniors, expectant and new mothers, and those recovering from an injury or illness. 855-6-HOME-NOW or handsfromtheharthomehealthcare.com.
Once in a while, a radio story is so compelling, it makes you drop everything to just listen. Well, we have a trove of those stories queued up for you. It's the 2011 Third Coast broadcast featuring the best of the best radio, the winners of our annual competition. Tales of friendship ripped apart by politics, of rescuing loved ones from the brink, and how a mixtape changed a young man's life. Do your ears a favor and tune in. Friday night at 10 on WHYY.
Tofu turkey won't fly, and deep-fried turkey can be dangerous. And turducken? Really? Thanksgiving dinner doesn't have to come with extra calories or mystery recipes. WHYY.org/fit is here to help. Send your Thanksgiving dinner questions to fit at WHYY.org. We'll post the answers, plus amazing easy recipes and ways to slash your budget. WHYY.org/fit for a happier, healthier Thanksgiving.
supporting WHYY 10,000 villages with 10 fair trade retail stores in the greater Philadelphia area, offering jewelry, personal accessories, home decor, and gifts designed to inspire holiday gift giving. Locations at 10,000villages.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. And part of our continuing conversation about our healthcare system, we asked Ezekiel Emanuel to join us on Radio Times. He worked on the healthcare bill that was passed into law last year, working for the Obama administration. He's now at the University of Pennsylvania, chairs the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy. Any questions or comments? Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY. So picking up on what we were talking about right before the break in terms of, you know, getting more compliance and getting patients in a sense and physicians and healthcare professionals working together on their healthcare. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah. So I think there, I was saying that there are some groups that have gotten their compliance rate up in, past 95% and in some cases to 99% through a variety of mechanisms, giving the patients the medications when they leave, having a nurse or a medical assistant call them at home to make sure they're taking them and taking them properly, and you know, forming a team with them to encourage them and make them want to do it. And remember, for many people, especially if the medication is to prevent something bad, investing now to prevent something in the future, that's very hard to do for all of us. We know that because not all of us are great savers, and you know, not all of us do all the preventative stuff we're supposed to do, even well-educated, relatively well-off people. So we have to have, I think, sympathy for people who find this a challenge.
You've been writing about our healthcare system in the New York Times, had a piece in yesterday's paper where you say the healthy Americans consume about 3% of our healthcare costs, and the sickest, 10%, consume about 64% of the cost, which shouldn't be surprising because they need health care.
Right.
But how can we – is that sustainable? And we're talking about a $2.6 trillion being spent, and obviously looking into the future, I don't know if we can cut those costs or not, but is that sustainable?
What isn't sustainable is the growth over time. So for the past 30-plus years – healthcare has grown at 2% faster than the underlying economy. That has had a terrible effect on the whole rest of the economy. It's resulted in flat wages for the last 30 years. It's resulted in state budgets, sort of money being taken away from almost everything else to go into support Medicaid. It's part of the reason we have the current deficit and, more importantly, the long-term projected deficit. We're spending too much on healthcare by any stretch of the imagination, including the fact that we're not getting as much quality as we should be for all that money. We know we can do it for much less. Europe, top-flight countries that don't have long lines like Switzerland or Germany or Sweden, do it without as much money as we're spending. So we can spend less.
You talked about teams, and I'm assuming teamwork is probably one way to reduce costs and hopefully increase quality. Now, this gets into some of the weeds here, but you also say that this fee-for-service structure that we use for paying for healthcare has to be looked at and possibly reformed.
No, I don't say possibly reformed.
It must be reformed.
We have to get out of the fee-for-service system. It has a perverse incentive, which is you pay doctors to do more. Surprise, they will do more. Some of what they do more of will be valuable, and some of what they do more of will not be valuable and will either be of no value, and there are unfortunately as many things in the American healthcare system where we actually pay and it's proven not to be a value or not proven to be valuable despite being very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to get out of that system, and the only way to get out of that system is to change how we pay doctors and hospitals and the other healthcare providers. Again, that's not going to be easy, and the reason it's not going to be easy is we've built up a whole big system around that. We have to evolve over the next decade to not rely on fee-for-service payment.
And you talk about bundling. I mean, essentially what, one charge?
Bundling is one of the multiple mechanisms that gets us. The reason I wrote about bundling in yesterday's Times is because I think it's one where, at least for a few important services, we can start it now. We have enough experience in some procedures. It's also another area where when you have a defined time period and you know what's encompassed, you can actually go for it. So in my area, in oncology, someone gets diagnosed with newly diagnosed breast cancer, we know that there's going to be surgery, probably radiation, 6 months of chemotherapy treatment, and then a defined follow-up. So we can actually put a bundle together pretty well. But again, doctors haven't been trained in how to manage to a bundle, to reduce their risk of, you know, taking a big loss. It's going to take time to make that transition. But bundling is a very good place to start. We've got experience with it, and that's the reason I wrote about it, because part of what I wanted to give people is, look, we don't have to wait a decade to get some of these solutions in place. We can start now. It's, again, it's not going to be easy. It is going to cause some pain, but we're going to get the transition going.
Is all this an argument, though, for a single-payer system?
Absolutely not.
Well, I knew you were going to say that, but when you talk about all the complexities, all the bureaucracy, all the paperwork, all the players in the system, and I'm not an expert on single-payer, but nonetheless, the sort of Medicare for all idea, which is that we're all part of the same system, wouldn't that address some of the problems we've been talking about?
We all have to be part of the same system in the sense of financing, because we need to pool the money and finance, and that allows us to get the sick as well as the well in, and that is very important. But there are lots of reasons not to have only one payer with one set of policies. Let me begin with, in the entire world, there is not a single system that manages something for 300 million plus people. That would be impossible, I think, to do efficiently.
It's just we have too many people in this country.
It would be too complicated to have one system. Second, if it's Medicare for all, I can tell you, having worked in the government carefully, the people at Medicare are hardworking, want to do the right thing, but they face two problems. One is they don't have enough money for the administration job they do. And Congress is constantly, I think, not paying enough on administration. It's one of the things that is inherent in Washington. We think it's all a waste, but you have to administer things. And Medicare doesn't have enough to administer. Everyone pounds their chest and says, look, Medicare can administer for 3%. There are many things Medicare can't do because it has too little money in the administration pot. And I think that would be a tendency in a single-payer system. Second, you need innovation. Innovation in how you pay and delivery, and having one monolithic group makes change and switching things very difficult. It's very slow. You want dynamic reform. You need to have lots of companies trying different things and seeing which ones work, and also which ones fail, because one of the ways we learn is you're never going to get a situation where everything succeeds. Even the smartest students fail a fair amount of times, and that's very important to success.
We dredged up something that you wrote back in 2005. Headline, it was in Washington Monthly, actually, and the headline is, "Solved. It covers everyone. It cut costs. It can get through Congress. Why universal health care vouchers is the next big idea." And on your list of 10 principles is every American under the age of 65 will get a voucher. There'd be a choice of health care plans. You would decouple insurance and employers. That was 6 years ago. Do those ideas still hold today?
It depends what you mean by still hold today.
Idea of a voucher.
That's not the healthcare system we have. That's not what was passed in the Affordable Care Act. It's not the system we're going to go forward with. So it's not applicable to today.
So even on if the it worked, other, I mean, it's not the system that we have today.
We're not, we passed a reform law. Our job now is to implement it well. That was the most important thing, that this wasn't the proposal being adopted. And it, by the way, it's not the proposal that Romney's proposing when he talks about vouchers or Paul Ryan's proposing when he talks about vouchers. I do think there are some things that we did advocate in that piece that I think are important. I don't think in the long run having health care tied to employment is a very good idea. There are some arguments for it. One of them is employers will take seriously their responsibility to promote the wellness of their workers. that actually has been rising over the last few years. But I am not a big fan. There are many, many better arguments as to why we want to decouple employment and insurance, allowing people to change jobs without worrying, allowing people to make choices, not their employer to make choices where they get insured. I think actually if you put everyone into one marketplace, like the exchanges that are part of the Affordable Care Act, you get a lot more price competition among the insurers. So I would say that on balance, I think that is an element I would like to promote more.
And that's Ezekiel Emanuel. He's the Vice Provost of Global Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania, where he also chairs up or chairs the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy. He's also a senior fellow for the Center for American Progress and a former healthcare advisor for the Obama administration. And if that last name sounds familiar, his brother is Rahm Emanuel. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get, looks like Eric from Kensington to join our conversation. Eric, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I have three quick comments to make, and I'll try to keep them brief.
Please.
I spent over 10 years in a major medical system here in the Philadelphia area, and I've also spent time in the medical military system, and for a brief period, I was a patient. So I've gotten to see this from three sides. And what I see as three primary factors that contribute to the cost of health care in this country are waste, which is a huge one, payment fragmentations, and patients being overwhelmed when it comes to paying their bills. In terms of the waste, I'll keep this one brief.
Well, you know what, Eric? Only because we have a whole bunch of people that want to join us, and you put three important things on the table here, waste, the payment system, and overwhelmed patients. Let me give our guests a chance to weigh in on those three.
So I would actually agree with you on all three. On the waste, I did write an article last week, which was about administrative waste and the waste related to billing and the paperwork. And, you know, the estimates, I think, by prudent conservative assessment of the system is we could probably save $30-plus billion dollars a year by going electronic on the billings and going electronic with some of the other aspects of the system, like physician credentialing. There are other aspects of waste. I don't disagree with you, and I'll be writing about some of those subsequently.
Stay tuned.
Payment fragmentation, you're absolutely right. Lots of insurance companies doing the same thing but with different forms. It also makes it hard, as I talk about in this yesterday's piece, it makes it hard to change how we pay doctors and to provide the same kind of incentive to them if they're paid for different things by Medicare, by Aetna, by United Healthcare, by WellPoint. It's very hard for doctors then to change the way they're practiced. We do need for them to get a consistent message across their payer profile. So that's absolutely right. And then you're absolutely right. To the extent that was mentioned, 10% of the sickest patients use about 2/3 of the healthcare dollars. Those patients tend to have chronic and multiple chronic diseases, and they are easily overwhelmed with what they're doing, trying to figure out what to go next. So you're absolutely right. All three of those are key elements in the high cost of this system that can be addressed.
Eric, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Kathy from Wincote has to say. And Kathy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
I have a question about the mandate part of the Affordable Care Act, probably the most controversial part of it. It looks like it's going to the Supreme Court.
It is.
So I want to know from your guests, if the Supreme Court rules against the mandate, what that does to the advantages of the act that he's been talking about. And I will take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Kathy.
First of all, the Supreme Court is not going to rule against the mandate. The mandate is absolutely constitutional. Many even conservative commentators and, I would note, conservative justices on the D.C. Circuit Court, the highest court underneath the Supreme Court, have said this is an open and shut case. This is not even – there's no constitutional grounds to say the mandate isn't something Congress can do, and there's no grounds in Supreme Court precedent.
Although so, that – but that will be argued before the U.S.
That will
Supreme
be
Court.
Argued, but I – well, I will just reveal – I have two big bets for very expensive dinners that we win. The mandate is going to be overwhelmingly ruled as constitutional. You are right, though. If we take away the mandate, the exchange and the access will become a problem. And it'll become a problem especially for people who have pre-existing health conditions. The reason to have the mandate is if you're not required to have insurance, there's an easy way to game the system. You're healthy, you just stay out of the insurance market until you get sick and then you buy insurance. That is an unsustainable situation, as we all know. And we don't need to just imagine it or say that's in theory. We have practice where that's been tried. Seven states tried to get rid of this pre-existing disease exclusion, so prevented insurance companies to say we're not going to give you insurance because you have had cancer or heart disease or diabetes. And in each of those cases, without a mandate, insurance rates went through the roof, unaffordable. We have had a number of exchanges set up around the country, and they all end up going belly up because healthy people stay out, sick people go into the exchange, the rates go up, and then the insurance companies say, we're not playing in this game anymore. We're not getting enough people, and it's becoming too expensive for people. The only place that has been able to succeed with getting everyone involved, including sick people, and getting them a reasonable health insurance rate is Massachusetts, where they have a mandate. And by the way, it's extremely popular. And by the way, it works really well. And if you want to see how well it works, I encourage you to go to the website called the Massachusetts Connector and go and, you know, imagine you're buying insurance and see how easy it is and see if you wouldn't like that for your own system. Because that's what is coming with the Affordable Care Act. What they have in Massachusetts is what everyone is going to have the option of in the exchange.
Kathy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You are a bioethicist, and as someone that who has also been at the heart of some of the debate about our healthcare system and has looked at it as well from afar, have we resolved as a nation about what we think people deserve, whether we all should be part of the same system, whether we go it alone, that great sort of American individualism, and make decisions for ourselves? Have we resolved that?
Not all of those, but I do think we have resolved the issue of the individualism when it comes to healthcare. I don't think that's something we embrace. First of all, we have Medicare, and that is for everyone in over 65, and that turns out to be the most popular part of the American healthcare system. So the one where everyone's in, that's the most popular one. So I don't think this individualism. Second of all, it's not sustainable if people go their own way. We cannot have a healthcare insurance system, at least, and without an insurance system, you really and very expensive care, it's just untenable. We do have a lot of conflict, although I think it's much less conflict than is often portrayed in the media over what are the essential benefits that people ought to be entitled to and what should be discretionary and allow them to buy if they want and not buy if they don't. And, you know, it's funny because in my family, my personal family, I'm one of those guys who likes the skinny healthcare package. I say, you know, just give me the basics. I don't want all that fluff.
For myself.
Right. And whereas I have a brother who...
Shall remain nameless.
Well, he won't remain nameless. Ariel Emanuel, who is like, you know, he does everything. He wants everything covered all the time, and he will use a lot of health care. Good. He wants that. He should have that. He should pay for the extra. I should get the low, you know, basic model, the essentials. And I think that's the American way.
And that's Ezekiel Emanuel. And joining us today in Radio Times, we are talking about our healthcare system. He's a former healthcare advisor for the Obama administration. And as we all know, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to review some of the constitutional challenges to the healthcare bill. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, This is the Week That Is, 1812's annual political comedy. Starring Philadelphia's own Jennifer Child, Scott Greer, and others, This is the Week That Is brings you the latest news on everything from healthcare and the economy to dog curbing in South Philadelphia. Featuring a script that changes with the headlines. Tickets are now available at 215-592-9560 or 1812productions.org.
David Coleman Headley was one of the leaders of the terrorist attack on Mumbai. The son of a Pakistani father and American mother, Headley became a drug smuggler, then a DEA informant, and after 9/11, an Islamic militant while working for the DEA. On the next Fresh Air, we speak with investigative reporter Sebastian Rotella about his new Frontline documentary. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Holiday gatherings punctuate our year. They mark the change of seasons, but also personal changes and rites of passage in our lives. Sometimes there's word of a new job, a new baby, an illness, a separation, a death. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, Who's Coming to Dinner? How families mark the passage of time with pronouncements, births, feuds, and feasts over the holidays. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. We are talking about our health care system, our $2.6 trillion health care system. And again, Ezekiel Emanuel is our guest. And he's the new vice provost of global initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania. He also chairs the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy. And he's a senior fellow for the Center for American Progress. And as we've been talking during this hour, a former health care advisor for the Obama administration. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me talk about those end-of-life decisions. And you are a bioethicist, and your name came up a couple of years ago when there were all the discussions and accusations of death panels associated with healthcare reform. And as someone who's been with parents in a hospital, you know, figuring out how to have a good death in a hospital, do you think we have made progress on that issue, a good death?
Oh, absolutely. In the early 1980s or mid-1980s, when I decided to interrupt my medical school training to go do a PhD, which would focus, among other things, on end-of-life care, I was told by the dean of students at that time that that was a career ender. We don't talk about end-of-life care in the American medical system. And then when I started my oncology training in 1990, an article appeared where I was quoted in the Boston Globe about end-of-life care, and I was hauled in on the – that was on a Sunday. And the Monday, the head of the hospital called me and said, "You don't talk about end-of-life care as a member of this cancer institute." But by 1997, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, which represents all the cancer doctors in America, they had an annual major initiative around improving end-of-life care. They did a major survey of all the doctors. And what you found was all the major cancer centers began having palliative care services, hiring doctors to really do better at end-of-life care. They all began focusing on this area. So there's been a real sea change, certainly in the cancer community. Mm. And one way you can see it is that in the early 1980s, more than 70% of patients who had cancer died in the hospital. And today, it's under 30% of patients with cancer who die in the hospital. That's a huge change.
Most dying at home?
At home or nursing home when they're in nursing homes. Hospice, more than half the patients who have cancer have hospice. Now, are we at the right place? No. And are there horror stories still? Yes. Do we have more to do? Absolutely. And I would say that there are probably two or three things that the government can do or others can do to improve things. One, this conversation, you know, and I was a practicing oncologist caring for dying patients, it's not a conversation you look forward to, right?
No
one does. So it's got a very – it's emotionally trying. It takes a lot of time. You have to give doctors and nurses who engage in these conversations better training around communication about end-of-life care, not just general communication training but around end-of-life care. There are some – you know, well-documented, well-tested programs about it. But I think regular training like that would help. That's one thing. Second, recognizing that it's emotionally trying, that everyone tries to avoid it, that
including the doctors and nurses.
Doctors, nurses, family. No one wants this conversation, that it can take a lot of time. We have to recognize that and compensate people for doing it. It's not like this is a conversation which, you know, through the goodness of their heart, they're going to do. It takes time. Time is, you know, what we pay doctors for. So we have to think about how to compensate and at least remove the disincentive for. And my own recommendation to doctors, and I found this easier when I adopted this approach, was I filled out a living will for myself. It's one area that I've done a lot of research in and advocated. If you go into a patient and you say, listen, I filled out this living will. It's not communicating anything to you. I'm in perfect health. It's not communicating anything about your health. It is something that people do as part of planning. Because all the bad, terrible, awful cases about end-of-life care, they're all young people where it happened unexpectedly. Some accident happened. Something untoward happened. So we all need to prepare for this, no matter what health we're in. I think that helps. And I think having doctors complete an advance directive would also help facilitate that conversation. But even when it facilitates it, it's still not an easy conversation to have, and we need to recognize that as a society.
But the fact that all that you just said was turned into a, you know, death panels, and you were called Dr. Death, and the idea of compensating physicians or people in the medical community for having end-of-life decisions, what does that tell you about our not just our political system, but perhaps even our, you know, our media and how we talk about this kind of stuff?
So let me say two things. First of all, I do think it shows that the political system, unfortunately, can be demagogued way too easily, and I think the media can facilitate that demagoguery, and it's not a credit to either. But this idea, again, it's not a partisan idea. Senator Johnny Isaacson, who's a very conservative member of the Senate from the Republican side, introduced a bill about encouraging and paying doctors to talk about end-of-life care. Sarah Palin, when she was governor of Alaska, had a whole month devoted to patients, to Alaskans getting advance directives. Newt Gingrich endorsed the idea. And then suddenly, you know, when they can use it conveniently to attack the president and attack the Affordable Care Act and the Democrats, they just turn hypocritically on this. So I think there's a lot of hypocrisy. There's a lot of demagoguery. But I also think it backfired. Remember when the Republicans tried to make an issue out of Terri Schiavo in Florida a few years ago and bring up a bill into the Senate and all of this? The American public reacted quite negatively to that, and it backfired, and it, you know, damn near ruined a career of a very honorable senator from Tennessee, Bill Frist, when he took the wrong side on that. Mm. And it seems to me the American public doesn't like this issue to be politicized and does want the government to recognize that and facilitate it. Facilitate the discussion and the decision at the doctor-patient relationship. Not to get involved, not to tell patients what to do, to provide the opportunity for a discussion. And that's what the American public wants. And I think you're going to see the demand. And, you know, if you ask me, before the end of the decade, we are going to be recognizing this in terms of compensating doctors for a conversation about advanced care planning.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Isaac from West Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Isaac, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi there. I really appreciate your conversation. Thanks. I like your comment on how the population discusses end-of-life care. One comment that I think that hasn't been brought to the table with regards to the current debate on healthcare reform is tort reform. And I think currently in medical education and like resident and fellow training, doctors are trained to practice defensive medicine because it's quite easy for patients with an adverse outcome or an ideal outcome to file a claim. And it's cheaper for insurance companies to settle the claim than to litigate it. And so doctors end up excess or unnecessary tests rather than relying on their clinical decision-making, adding an expensive amount of cost to the system. I'd like to hear your comments, and I'll listen to them off the air.
Thanks, Isaac. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Go ahead.
So let me make three points about this. The first point is I'm very sympathetic to doctors. A recent study in the New England Journal showed that even in low-risk areas like pediatrics and dermatology, a majority of doctors over the entire career are likely to be sued. So it's now, you know, routine for almost every doctor to confront this, even the best of them. And that's, I agree, unacceptable, and it has its scars even if they're declared innocent and no money gets traded hands. So I understand that. Second, on the other hand, we need to be clear about whether this is going to save money or not. There have been several studies looking at the major way doctors want this to be solved by caps on the non-economic damages, They want it to reduce the statute of limitations to 1 year for adults, 3 years for kids. They want reduced contingency fees. People have looked at this, and you know, more than 30 states have some form of these caps, and it doesn't result in huge amounts of savings. It just doesn't. I know everyone talks about malpractice and lots of defensive medicine. There's lots of things driving doctors to do more. Malpractice is one of them. Just changing malpractice will not solve the problem and will not lead to a lot of savings. Having said that, my third point is, I agree. I would like to change the malpractice system. I was very active and supportive of that inside the administration. Unfortunately, we couldn't get the Republicans to agree. The president himself has been outspoken about that. If you go back to his September 2009 speech, he said he wants to do something. He did things administratively that was within his power, short of changing the law. In my view, although this is unproven and I recognize it, the thing you want is to have malpractice tied to adherence to guidelines, adherence to decision supports, and if you're following best practices, you are presumed to be have done it right and not to be liable for malpractice. That seems to me to get it right for doctors, to ensure that the malpractice system is encouraging high-quality care. I like that much better than caps on torts, which don't seem to improve quality. If anything, might there's some data suggesting they decrease it. But this is a problem. I think we have to solve it so that physicians get it out of their head and can focus in more on quality and more on saving costs. But I don't have the illusion that, that malpractice reform is going to save a lot of money for the healthcare system.
Isaac, thanks for calling into Radio Times. I remember reading a study, and I can't quote where it came from, but they the study looked at physicians actually talking to patients when things go wrong, finding that if doctors are willing to come forward and say, look, I'm so sorry, I messed up, this is what happened, that actually reduces the chance that someone's going to sue a doctor.
Absolutely right. So a number of places I would cite at this point, the University of Michigan Medical System, have introduced this SORRY Works program, which it goes by a number of names, but that's early offers is another way. And absolutely, the programs show the same thing, which is you acknowledge that an error has happened. You offer fair compensation to the family. Families get resolution much quicker. They're much more satisfied, much less likely to sue. And you improve the quality because you have people willing to say, we made a mistake here. How do we fix it? Now, what we do know is that at the places that have led on this, it has resulted in declines in malpractice premiums, whether that would be expand to everyone. And I should mention, President Obama, when he was a senator, introduced a bill to get this to be supported and to be the norm. He has, again, doctors should recognize, he has been a stalwart advocate for malpractice reform since his Senate days. This is something he does believe in, and he has tried to get it.
Let me get to, looks like Louise from Pennington to join our conversation. And Louise, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I'm very much enjoying the conversation today. I'm a certified nurse midwife, and I've been practicing and involved in births for about 35 years. And I've seen the rate of C-section go from 6% maybe in 1976 to now between 38 and 40%. Wow. It's maternity is responsible for over 50% of all hospital admissions, and the C-section is the most common surgery, as far as I know, in the U.S. And a lot of it, I think, is just patterns of practice that if those could be addressed, there'd be a huge amount of cost saving.
Well, Louise, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give our – it looks like you're nodding your head, Ezekiel.
Well, there's no doubt that we have too many C-sections and that, again, the incentive structure and again, not just the payment, but lots of things encourage the use of C-sections, convenience for the patient and the doctor, caution, being able to schedule it, and the payment. And I agree that – we probably have twice as many as I think it's suggested would be the right number, whatever the right number is. And so you're absolutely right. This is a case of where we have to change the financial incentives. We have to change the convenience attitude about natural childbirth. It's better for the baby, better for the mom. So I think you're right. It's a case where this is clearly something where the norm of the profession needs to take a lead and change. And there's very little justification for what we do there.
Louise, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Looking at the Affordable Care Act, which was signed into law last year, are there things out missing from that act that you think would have improved it?
Oh, of course. I think this is probably a B-plus bill, which is very, very good, certainly above average. It has a lot of things that are very positive in the bill. I think one of the major issues is that some of them have come in less robustly than I want. We could have accelerated things in the timeline. I would say one major area that is problematic and that we were intending to change it if it had gone to conference was we have state exchanges rather than a national or regional exchanges. And I think that increases the complexity of the system, increases reinvention in each state. That was one where I think everyone agreed we would have preferred a national or a set of regional exchanges. So there are lots of parts of the bill I've mentioned in one of my columns that the administrative simplification could have probably gone faster and done more than what was in the bill. The bundling provision, I think, could have, again, done more, done it on a faster time scale. So there are things which are changed. Having said all of that, this is a world historical event. We've been trying in American history 100 years to get health care reform passed. President Obama finally got health care reform enacted, and it's going to make a major difference. Every American is going to be better off because of this bill at the end of the decade. The growth, the in-between is going to be hard, but there's no doubt this is going to make our health care system better and all of us much healthier.
So we have to make it through those teenage years, as you described.
Right.
Well, Ezekiel Emanuel, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And he's vice provost of Global Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania, where he also chairs the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy, one of our continuing conversations about our healthcare system. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for joining us.